Welcome to Property Litigation Bites by Hargan Wolf, delivering the latest analysis of property litigation trends to UK landowners, developers, landlords, and tenants.
This episode of the podcast looks at taking farming land back in hand from a tenant. We explore why a rural landowner might want to do this and what challenges rural landowners are likely to face when taking a farm back in hand. I'm Estella Prince, a legal director and specialist rural property disputes solicitor at Hargan Wolf. My area of expertise is the rural business and estates arena, hence why I'm talking to you today. Joining me for today's chat is James Bush, a director at specialist land and estate agency firm GSC Grays. James, I'm delighted you can join us. Why don't you start telling us a bit about your area of expertise?
Thanks, Estella. Yeah, my name's James Bush. I'm a director based in North Yorkshire for GSC Grays. And as Estella quite rightly says, we're estate management, planning and development, farm business and residential farm and country house agency. So we're quite a diverse business. My particular role is head of farm business. So I concentrate almost entirely on farms and estates from an operational point of view, helping them not only with farm management and land management advice, but also in terms of financial budgeting, cash flows, and financial support. It's quite a diverse role in many respects, but dovetails quite nicely with the estate management side of the business.
In your experience then, James, is this becoming more of a regular occurrence that a farmer or landowner looks to take farm back in hand to consider different ways they can use the land? Is this something you're seeing increasingly often?
I think it is. I think there was quite a significant push towards considering what options were last year, particularly pre-budget, when there was a bit when we weren't sure exactly which way it was going to go. So there was a lot of consideration about land coming back in hand, tenancies not being continued or renewed, and I think there was quite a big push towards sort of grazing licenses and those sort of things to manage the situation. It changed following the budget, I would argue, because there wasn't the need to go down that route in the same way as we'd anticipated. However, we're seeing more and more people still considering the options for taking out land back in hand, but not only that, different ways of operating the land. So it might be that they haven't necessarily taken it back from a tenancy, but they're looking at an alternative way of managing it going forward.
So why might they do that then? What are the decisions that are prompting landowners to relook at how they use their land?
I think there's a number of things. I think the first one and the big one that everyone talks about is inheritance tax and the tax planning. I think that's a significant sort of driver for many of the decisions that are being made. What I would say is it's probably not the only one that's driving people to make decisions. We have a need to protect the tax position, but we've also got to look at the succession opportunities for farmers and landowners. And actually, what does that look like going forward? So is it that we've got land that's come back in from a farm business tenancy or an AHA tenancy? Is it that the next generation aren't quite ready to take over, but the current generation are looking at options for retirement or winding down? And how do we manage that time in between? It might even be that given the challenging 12 months that we've had on the arable side, it might be that, well, economies of scale aren't there. So how do we manage the business, retain the asset and retain the active farmer status by using other means to manage the land? So it can be any one of a number of things that can drive it. But generally, some of the decision making comes to the same result. We're looking at these alternative uses.
So from what you appear to be saying then, it's the fact that landowners want to keep hold of the land. They don't, you know, they're not looking to sell it and relieve themselves of the obligation of looking after it. It's just that different changes in policy perhaps, or farming techniques and increases in machinery advances and environmental changes are raising these questions, and people are really having to think more carefully about how they adapt to this changing landscape in the future. So it seems to be that there's a bit of a landslide change going on at the moment in farming. Would you agree with that?
I think it's very much that. I think the other things, you know, you mentioned machinery there. It's becoming a significant part of any farming business. And actually, the capital cost when it comes to changing equipment, it really does make families think about whether they want to spend the money at all. You need a reasonably sized enterprise to justify the cost of some of this equipment. And actually, alternatives such as, you know, contract farming agreements or machinery sharing rings actually make a lot more sense because the capital cost is shared. And obviously, from an economies of scale point of view, that cost diluted over a larger acreage. So I think there are a number of drivers. We're in a challenging climate at the moment. Thankfully, livestock production's been positive, and we seem to be riding at a reasonable level in terms of income from the livestock sector. But arable's been really quite difficult this year, and I think we're set to have some challenges ahead in the next 12 months in terms of cash flow and such like. So there'll be some big decisions made over the next sort of 6 months as to where we're going into the next harvest year.
So if we take a fairly common situation then, kind of picking up on those areas of farming that you've talked about there, so a mix of traditional farm buildings and perhaps modern farm buildings as well. So you might have farmhouses that are tenanted out, as well as buildings that have been used to store and house cattle and machinery, and perhaps a mixture of animal farming and also arable farming. How would taking a farm back in hand work then? What would it look like? What would be the things that the farmer would have to consider?
So I think the first thing is, if you're taking land back in hand, if it's been previously let out, is actually what infrastructure is there on the farm? What equipment and means do you have to be able to farm the land? And are the enterprises that were on the land previously the right ones to be there now? So I think those are the first things you need to consider. The other thing to be mindful of is that when you do take this land in, you know, we're looking to maintain that active farmer status. So actually, there's certain things that you might do with the land that would mean that that isn't the case. You've also got to look at the distribution in terms of trading income versus investment income. So in terms of the outlook in what you do with the buildings and the land, what are you going to be doing with them? If it's a diversification opportunity, does it still fall under a trading activity, or does it become an investment activity? Because that in itself can make the difference between a 40% and 20% tax liability going forward. We've got an element of uncertainty in the next couple of months until we get the next budget. But as things stand at the moment, those are the considerations, really.
So potentially then, it's the landowner could look to completely change the use of their land and fields to the enterprise they'd used it for previously. And I know that you've mentioned to me pig and poultry models and things like that. Is that something you're seeing increasingly happening in the countryside?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, the livestock sector's buoyant. It seems to be going quite well, and that's across the piece. It's generally across everything. There is a big incentive at the moment, particularly in poultry, broilers, which are the meat chickens particularly, to get new sheds built. Most of the retailers have gone for voluntary reductions in stocking densities through animal welfare. So the knock-on effect of that is, as a nation, we need a 20% more shed space to accommodate just the same level of production in broilers. So that's quite a big driver. New sheds themselves, if a farmer can actually get permission to build one, are also driving premiums in the market. So in terms of the financial returns and the paybacks, the return on investment, much quicker. So actually, it's a very feasible thing to look at the moment, but it has its own issues, particularly pigs and poultry. More of an intensive production system, they have their own issues in terms of nutrients and everything else that they might be producing, and actually disposal of the muck, and that in itself can be an issue, as we've seen across the country in a River Wye and such like. It's significant. So planning's the biggest hurdle, but if you can get it, it's certainly a worthwhile exercise.
So I suppose that alongside the planning considerations, you've also got, I mean, presuming these are new buildings as well, they're not actually conversions, are they? They're having to be completely new structures that are going up.
I think it depends again. So it depends what the buildings were used for previously. So there is an argument that you can convert pigs to poultry or vice versa, because in terms of the construction, it's similar. It's not easy, but it's similar. But generally, I think anyone building poultry buildings now would be building new, as they would with the pigs. You know, the poultry industry, most of the sheds are quite dated. So I would argue about 50-60% of the buildings are over 20 years old.
I know, speaking from my experience, when we've been asked to advise on these types of issues, farmers come to us with buildings that they've taken back on tenancies and can have significant issues with dilapidations. You know, they haven't been looked after well, or changes have been made which affect what they can do to them in the future. And together with access disputes, because presumably a change of use can also mean a change in how the access is used. There might be a lot more traffic going to a site than there was previously. You might need larger vehicles being able to access the site. And these are all considerations that any landowner will have to take into account when considering these types of changes. Well, I know from a personal point of view, because I live in a rural market town as well, and we've had a lot of building of new houses recently that are kind of encroaching or abutting up to farmland. And farmers also have to be wary of taking actions that could constitute a nuisance, you know, increasing noise from these kind of units, and also smells that emanate from them as well. People have got to be able to get on, haven't they, within their local environment and bring the communities with them. And all these considerations have to be factored in, don't they, especially where you're close to residential conurbations.
Well, absolutely. They're probably the biggest considerations, but they're probably also the biggest things that will have an effect on the planning consents as well. You know, so noise in particular, smell. Unfortunately, these types of systems are generally the smelliest of them. So suppression is certainly something that's considered. When we're talking about pig industry, you know, there's a big push towards the handling of slurry, and actually slurry stores being roofed over, making sure that you don't get that sort of gaseous emission from the slurry while it's stored. So there are things we can do to mitigate, but it's still a challenge to get something located close to a conurbation of any sort that might cause an issue.
So that's very succinctly looked at the change of use of lands and fields. So when we look at the actual holding itself, it might have a mixture of traditional buildings.
I think most farmers, when they look at their sheds, will start with thinking, how can we use it agriculturally first? What can they do that? And work through a bit of a process, really, and understand whether that's a feasible option. Whether there's enough return on investment if they do commit to it. They'll then move at looking at alternatives, so in terms of diversification. So it might be the more simple diversification, where it's a change of use and going to something like storage and distribution, or it might be something a bit more complex where they'd look at development farm shop, or it might be, as you say, residential lets or holiday lets. This comes back to the original point I was making, though. These considerations have to be looked at in terms of tax and any changes that might be coming. And whilst we don't want to let the tax tail wag the dog, it's sort of, we've still got to consider it, because the difference between something being an investment as opposed to a trading activity is significant in terms of the tax burden under IHT. To use one example, livery stables can be a little bit contentious in terms of how they're deemed, for the simple fact that HMRC would look at them and say, well, it's a rental of land and you're keeping a horse there and you're just renting the land. So it's investment rather than trading. So that comes back to, what activities do you undertake as part of the livery rental for the client? You know, whether you're taking the horses in and out, whether you're exercising them, whether you're mucking out, whether you're, you know, what additional elements are you offering, and can that be classed as trading? So these are significant considerations with whatever you do. That's just one example, to make sure that it falls within the trading element and not falling into the investment category.
Yes, that's really interesting. There's so much for landowners to consider these days. They really do need to make sure they've got the right experts on board with them, because there's all these pitfalls that inadvertently acting in the best interest of what they think is the right thing to do, and then coming a cropper when it comes to deciding which tax treatment goes to a particular element of the investment. And that there's also the regulation from a letting point of view. So in our world, there's a change in legislation going through Parliament at the moment that's going to affect how residential properties can be let out, how a tenant can obtain better security of tenure, make it quite difficult for landowners to evict tenants if they want to get the properties back for any purpose. And there's a lot of uncertainty as to policy changes and things that might happen in the future. And it's hard to say with any certainty that you might want to tie up the use of land for 20, 30, 40 years, and commercial lettings as well. You know, if you're going to let out to a commercial tenant, you have to be very wary of the 1954 Landlord and Tenant Act, whereby you can inadvertently grant a commercial tenant security of tenure, making it very difficult to get them out. On one hand, you might not want to. You might be very happy to have a secure tenant there paying the rent month in, month out. But say you did have some development plans for the future in terms of the holding, it can make it more tricky to negotiate with tenants if this hasn't been thought about at the outset. So a lot to think about there.
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right. Getting the right advice in the first place is the key. We can only really work with the cards we've been dealt. So at any point in time is really understanding what the position is as it stands, and actually, would that decision be the right decision for the business as we stand, and can it repay, can it cover the tax liability where we are at the current time? As you know, the political landscape has changed things significantly in the last 18 months, and I'm not sure we can't second guess. We have to just work with what we've got. But I think the key is getting that right advice early on. I would also argue that generally, you know, what suits an accountant's position or a solicitor's position don't necessarily say the same thing at the outset. And actually, the easiest way is get them in the room together so we can actually have those conversations. Say, well, it might be the lesser of two evils, depending on what needs to be done. And similarly, from our point of view, particularly when we're talking about the inheritance tax element of it and the forward planning and the physical sort of management of the property, being in those discussions early on with accountants and solicitors gives us the opportunity to talk about the various areas and the various pitfalls. I think if we took everybody's advice on the face of it and we didn't have that cross communication, I don't think you would ever move forward and do anything. So I think it's key that everyone's involved from the start.
So in terms of when you talk about succession planning then, are we still looking at quite a traditional model here where a landowner will look to safeguard this investment and this land for future generations? Or are people becoming less willing to take on these responsibilities and other solutions are having to be considered as well?
I think there's, again, a number of considerations. The next generation are taking their time to understand whether they want to be involved with a business. I think it's very easy to think, well, we've been farming for five generations, well, I'm going to farm it. Well, it's not necessarily much of a prospect in certain areas at the moment. What we are finding is that to sort of give the time and give the next generation the chance to decide whether they want to be involved, many farmers are getting to the point where they're getting to the point of retirement and saying, well, actually, we don't want to sell up, because it's the family home and the family farm. But similarly, we don't want to force the hand of the next generation to take it on at a time that they're not happy to. So this is where we're looking at options such as contract farming arrangements, where a farmer can maintain the active farmer status, is still farming the land, but in conjunction with a contractor. And when I say contractor, that's not a dedicated contracting business necessarily. It might be the neighbouring farmer who has the ability to farm that land. They have an agreement where they both get a get a return from it, a standard return, and then they get divisible surpluses afterwards. But what it does is it maintains that position in terms of tax to allow the next generation the time to decide whether they want to delve into it and take it on. So it's, yeah, there's many, many conversations going on. On the flip side of that, we are sitting many clients down with the family and saying, well, do you have an interest in it? And quite often we're having, well, no. So then it's a different prospect. It's looking at what are the options, how long has the current generation got in terms of the sort of working life that they want to continue doing it, and actually is an exit strategy the other option. So yeah, we're having quite difficult conversations, but quite meaningful ones on a daily basis, I would argue, at the moment.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that we've gone from this very traditional AHA tenancy, which granted succession for many generations, to farm business tenancies, which gave a lot more flexibility, to now looking at these contracting out models, which are more flexible still. And it does seem to be a sign of the times that, and maybe because of a bit of insecurity in policy and legislation frameworks, that landowners are seeking to keep as much flexibility in what they do as possible.
I think absolutely. I think that is part of it. I think the other thing that we've got to consider is, and I know we've talked previously, is that, you know, the contract farming or the share farming model allows the sort of inheritance tax APR BPR calculation to encapsulate the whole business, because you're still maintaining an agricultural business. So that what I mean by that is, you know, if you live in the farmhouse, but you're not really wanting to farm the land yourself, if you rent the farm land out on an FBT and the farmhouse no longer forms part of that business, it's not the central hub to it, there is a potential for it falling outside of the agricultural property relief calculation. And if it does, some houses are quite sizable and have quite a value to them, it's quite a significant tax liability. So the contract farming agreements and share farming agreements allow that capacity to maintain that house within the APR BPR calculation, saving potentially 20% tax if something should happen. So I think the sort of shorter agreements allows the control to remain with the farmer, but it also gives that flexibility to sort of give time to make decisions, and it, in some respects, gives some of the next generation that haven't got family farms a chance to get into the industry. You know, so the contractor could be a new entrant to farming who hasn't got the capacity, hasn't got the land, but has the willingness and the, you know, the desire to work. So they can be the contractor in this. So they can build a business without necessarily having the asset behind them in the first place.
I think, as we're hearing on the news and everything, that tax liability is better spent as an investment in the farming enterprise than potentially, you know, going to the central coffers to maintain the longevity and the sustainability of the holding for the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
As part of safeguarding the holding for potential future generations and for the landowners' personal aims, at the end of the day, landowners have to make a profit. It has to be a profitable enterprise. So how do changes in policy and legislation and the old subsidy levels, how are they affecting landowners at the moment?
Well, it's a good point that you make. It's significant. We've had a transition from the area-based payments through basic payment scheme, transitioning away from being paid just purely on the area you've got, and that transition towards the sort of environmental schemes that are there to provide some public good and environmental benefit. The tricky bit that we've had is that actually many farms have been reliant on the BPS payments in the past, and we're trying to transition them away from being overly reliant on them. Easier said than done. Particularly 2 years ago, challenging markets across agriculture that meant that wasn't necessarily the easiest thing to do. It's improved more recently. But I think when we look at the environmental schemes and grants, the issues that we've had this year with SFI being stopped very abruptly, and no guarantees of when the next one's coming out, shows the sort of volatility of the industry to those schemes, and the fact that over reliance on them is probably not the right thing either. So farmers need to consider what their options are. It might be that they look at other things. Natural capital is one, but the overarching driver for us is actually looking at the overall farm profitability. And as things change in the political landscape and IHT requirements and the liabilities that might come with it, how can we weather that? And the only way to really weather that is to build farm profitability. So actually looking at, you know, how we can get that to a sustainable level going forward to cover it. And that's the tricky bit. Unfortunately, agriculture are still very much price takers rather than price makers. So, you know, my challenge within the farm business team is actually speaking to farmers and saying, well, we can't control what we're getting for it necessarily. There are means to do, you know, niche stuff, or, you know, if we're working as a cooperative, we maybe have a little bit more selling power. But the reality is the bits that we can control are the variable costs, the costs of production. Those are the bits where we can have an effect, and albeit we can't change them dramatically, we might be able to make small changes to a number. The collective effect is positive. So that's where our sort of focus is at the moment, is looking at controlling the controllables, as we like to say. And again, assessing whether the business can be profitable.
So just to touch on something else you mentioned then about the natural capital and how to derive the maximum output for your land. There's been a lot of talk about biodiversity net gains in farming, and also carbon capture, carbon storage as being ways to assist in the long-term profitability of farms. But again, these have been in the news, out of the news, popular then unpopular. How are these translating on the ground at the moment? What are you hearing about these kinds of schemes?
So again, there was quite an appetite, particularly when BNG became a thing, 18 months ago now, I think, was when it came out, early 2024. There was quite a lot of appetite in farmers and trying to understand what opportunity might be there under BNG. Carbon similar in terms of, you know, selling carbon units as a tradable commodity. The difficulty with any of this is that, one, as you said, it's gone a bit quieter just recently, and we don't know really what the long-term prospects for it are. What we do know is that if a farm commits to going down the route of generating BNG units or carbon units and then trades those units, there is an element of commitment for a much longer period. So BNG, arguably 30 years plus, carbon, much longer. The slight worry is, and we don't know how this will play out, is whether committing that land to a particular use to generate these units then locks that land in perpetuity in some respects. So even, you could argue carbon's a little bit clearer in terms of it's a longer term. Trees are a good example. You put trees in the ground to generate the carbon unit, those trees are going to be there probably indefinitely. So you know you've got a change of that land use. BNG is a little bit more of a grey subject, in so much as you enhance the biodiversity for a period of 30 years to support a development or whatever that's for. Once you get to the end of the 30 years, what happens with the land? If you've got a high level of biodiversity and it becomes designated in any shape or form, you've then locked that land into that use. And I don't know whether it's the right term or not, but you've almost sterilized it against any change of use beyond it that would be detrimental to that biodiversity. So I would be cautious. I'm not saying that you wouldn't do it. I think actually there is certainly, you should consider it in the right areas. So certain pieces of land would be absolutely ideal for it, but it is something that should be considered carefully to make sure that you're not sterilizing that land against future use and actually tying the hands of future generations into something that they might not be able to do anything about.
And equally, a change of policy again and a new scheme, and, you know, it could really affect the viability of this scheme, couldn't it, which carries an element of risk.
Yeah. And I think one other consideration to make is as well, if you're committing to contracts to deliver this type of benefit, just from an insurance point of view and liability, put the business's own liability for it, you're committed to delivering it and you don't want to fall foul. So make sure that you've got the appropriate insurance in place and exactly what you're committing to delivering.
That's been really interesting, James. Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. So I think to wrap up what we've been saying, entering commercial agreements and contracts, such as different farming models, repurposing buildings, letting buildings, these are all really good opportunities for landowners, but each comes with its own set of legal planning and compliance risks and things to think about. So the key takeaway is that early engagement with professionals is critical to mitigate these risks. Get your experts on board early, your solicitors, planners, tax advisors, farm business consultants, land agents, because a little foresight now can prevent potentially expensive mistakes and disputes later. Thank you very much, James.
It's been a pleasure.
So thank you all for listening to this episode of the Property Litigation Bites podcast, hosted by me, Estella Prince, and special guest James Bush. If you have any questions about today's discussion, you can find me and James on LinkedIn, and you can also contact us at hello@hargenwolf.co.uk.
Thank you for listening to Property Litigation Bites. Hargan Wolf is an award-winning UK law firm specialising exclusively in property litigation and disputes. If you would like to discuss any of the issues covered in this episode, please contact us at hello@hargenwolf.co.uk. You can also find us on LinkedIn. Visit www.hargenwolf.co.uk for further insight and analysis.